Welcome to this episode of My Journey as a Physicist. Each episode features an interview with a physicist to learn about their work, their interests outside of physics, and their professional journey of how they ended up where they are today. Season 3 features physicists involved in the long-range plan for nuclear science. I hope you enjoyed today's episode.
Welcome, Gail Dodge. It's great to have you here. And to get started, the first question I want to ask is just to tell us about yourself and your day-to-day and what part you're playing in the long-range plan for nuclear science.
Sure. Okay. So my name is Gail Dodge, and I'm a professor of physics at Old Dominion University, which is in Norfolk, Virginia. And Norfolk, Virginia is close to where Jefferson Lab is, and that's where a lot of my research is based. That's the Thomas Jefferson National Accelerator Facility, known as JLab. Not just a professor of physics, now I'm the dean of the College of Sciences. So I've gone into administration, actually. And that means that my day-to-day work is largely concerned with being dean of the college, which, you know, means responsibility for the academic programs and the research for 7 departments in the area of science, including math and psychology, computer science and oceanography. So my day-to-day scope has broadened beyond physics. You know, I love physics and I enjoyed my time as a researcher, but now I'm more of an administrator. And you asked about the long-range plan. So as part of my career, I have done a couple of things. One is that I was a program manager at the National Science Foundation for a couple of years, and I worked a lot not only with the NSF at that time, but with the Department of Energy. And I'm familiar with the Department of Energy in other ways. And at one time, I served on the NSAC, Nuclear Science Advisory Committee. And so when the time came to find a new chair of NSAC, they chose me. For about 2 years now, I've been chair of NSAC. And as part of that responsibility, we do the long-range planning exercise when we're asked to by the agencies. So the Department of Energy and the NSF will charge NSAC to do different things. It's not always about a long-range plan, but right now we have a charge to produce a long-range plan. And that process will take about 18 months. And so we're just at the beginning of that process. And so my role as part of the long-range planning process is to pull together the team, the committee of people that's going to ultimately write the long-range plan and consider the different recommendations. So it's already hard just to find the right committee and to have it be balanced and, you know, to make sure everyone's voice is heard. But that committee will be, you know, accepting a lot of input in the form of white papers from all over the community. And the community includes lots of different types of physics. So I think I'm going to stop there because I don't know exactly what kind of information you want or what, you know, where you want me to go with all this.
I think that the main point of this season is to interview people who are connected to this long range plan.
Right.
You can talk as much as you want about it. The next question would be, when and how did you decide to become a physicist? And also related to that, like, when did you decide it was the right time to step into administration? And, you know, why did you choose to do that?
Yeah, the first question is easier than the second. So I was very much interested in physics in high school. And I really loved the interplay between math and physics. But I loved other things as well. And when I went to college, I wasn't sure if I was going to major in physics or political science. Those are the two things I was trying to choose between. And I really loved both of those fields. And I ended up majoring in physics partly because I felt like it could postpone as long as possible my choice. You know, because you can sort of always read a book about political science topics, but you really need special training to do physics. And so I started down the physics path. So I ended up majoring in physics in college and, you know, enjoyed that tremendously, did undergraduate research in college. And that had a big impact on me. And I really enjoyed that. Then I went to grad school and I wasn't quite sure when I went to grad school what field I would go into. And I think that's true of a lot of graduate students, right? I mean, you may have an idea of what you're interested in studying, but so I did nuclear physics as my undergraduate research. And then I ended up doing nuclear physics as a graduate student. And that was also a good experience. And so, but even then I wasn't sure that I saw myself having a career in physics, because of course, all anyone could talk about is how, you know, it's so hard to find faculty positions and all. And, you know, I just assumed that that would be a very difficult path to take. But I thought, well, I'll go and do a postdoc. And I did a postdoc in Europe, which was so fun. I went to NEGEF, which is an electron scattering machine, similar to JLab, but lower energy, and right in Amsterdam. So I could live right in Amsterdam and spend 2 years in Europe. And that is fun. And that is one of the many great things about being in academia is that it takes you abroad sometimes. And that's a great experience to have. So I lived there for 2 years in Amsterdam. And then I was able to get a faculty job. And so I sort of followed a path, but I never was quite sure what that path was going to be. I didn't feel that I was destined to become a faculty member when I was younger, but it worked out for me to have that opportunity. And partly that's because Jefferson Lab was just opening and they were hiring for a lot of faculty at that time. So I was lucky enough to get one of those positions. And, you know, you ask a good question about why go into administration. And I never would have dreamed when I was an assistant professor or associate professor or full professor that that might be something that I would do. But what happened is that the position of chair of the department became open. And, you know, normally you would not think of a department chair as an administrator. That's really still more in the faculty side, but there is an administrative component, a big administrative component of that. And somehow when that chair position became open, I just said, wow, I really think I could do that. And I really want to do that. And I really liked the idea of trying to help the department run as smoothly as possible and enable people to learn and people to do their research and have everything run smoothly. Not that I was necessarily going to be able to make everything run smoothly, but I thought that I would love to do that. And so I tried that and I was chair for 6 years. And then I had to flirt with the idea of whether I should become a dean. And I wasn't sure that was the right path, but I ended up going to the National Science Foundation. And that's also, again, kind of a hybrid role. It's administration of research. And I really enjoyed that. I had a chance to learn about the research that a lot of people were doing outside of my own field. And I got a chance to know, for example, to visit Michigan State University and visit NSCL. That was so fabulous to see what's going on there and to hear about all the incredible research that's being done there. So I enjoyed learning about the other subfields of physics. That was a great part of that job. And so anyway, one thing led to another. And then I came back to Old Dominion University and a dean job came open. And so I applied and I was given that job. And I really do enjoy it because I think you can have an impact. But I know that many of my colleagues wonder why I went down that path. And I can understand why they would wonder. But for me, I think it was the right choice.
That's great. So my next question, which you don't have to answer if you're not comfortable, is were there any major obstacles that you had to overcome, whether that be your gender, was there long distance relationship stuff going on, anything like that?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. I really believe that most people, as they grow up and become young adults and then adults middle-aged, have things to overcome, right? In my case, I was pretty lucky that I was never treated badly, for example, being a woman in physics. You know, I know that some people are for sure, but I was lucky. I had great mentors. I had a lot of people encouraging me. I always felt welcomed. I think my obstacles were more internal. I always felt maybe that I wasn't quite good enough to do the job. And, you know, I worked so hard to try to be good enough and to try to, you know, to do a good job. I tried very hard to do a good job supervising my own students. And so I tried really hard. I did have, I would say, mainly internal obstacles, but everyone externally, I've been lucky in my life. You know, I had strong family support and I didn't meet my husband until I was already a faculty member. You know, so I didn't have the two-body problem, you know, and so that worked out luckily for me. I have one daughter and that's awesome. You know, I had her, you know, a little bit older than some people have their children, but that worked out. And so, yeah, I think it's the internal things. And I've tried really hard to work on issues of affecting women in physics because I can see how important it is to have a sense of community, how easy it is to get derailed if you're, let's say, the only woman in the class or if in any way you somehow don't feel like you belong, right? There's so many different ways that people can feel like they don't belong. Just because of my own experience, I've been more easily focusing on issues of women in physics. But I just know it is incredibly important for everyone to feel welcome and to have a sense of belonging. And it's, for some people, that comes naturally, you know, no matter what their situation is, they're outgoing or they just somehow naturally. And so we've worked hard at Old Dominion University to create a sense of community for the women in the physics department. We have these dinners twice per semester and everyone gathers, faculty, postdocs, graduate students, undergraduates. We really have tried hard to build that sense of community. Of course, that was struggling. We struggled a lot during the pandemic, but I think that's been important. And it's been important for me too, because at any stage in your life, you need mentors. You know, no matter where your situation is, you need to help others and others need to help you and you need advice and support. And so I think that that's a very important issue to me, helping all people feel welcome and included. And that's not just a question of physics, right? All fields have to pay attention to that issue. And it's not an easy problem to solve. We don't have, obviously, if you take the kind of obvious case of women in physics, we don't have a full representation of women in physics, obviously. And it's been very hard to change that. It's been very hard to move that needle. I do think that undergraduate research is one of the most effective ways of doing that, because when people have a chance to really work on something themselves with a very positive mentor, then they can start to get confidence and see themselves doing that kind of career. And so I'm a strong believer in undergraduate research for everyone, for anyone. because I think it helps people start to see themselves that maybe they could belong, maybe they can be part of that activity. And so that's one thing I feel strongly about.
Yeah, that's great. I totally agree. Stepping back a little bit, I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about what's it like to raise children while you're also off being this awesome physicist and administrator, I guess.
I know. And I know that so many people are worried, will they have time for work-life balance? You know, will they be able to find that right balance? And that was very important for me. I found that when you have children, you make time. I mean, you just make the time that needs to be made. And I've always put my daughter first, and you get your job done anyway. no one really benefits from working 20 hours a day or, whatever people want to claim that they're doing. Most people are not productive during that time. And I think people are more productive when they switch their attention to something else, like their family or whatever, and then go back to it. And so I was always worried, and it was sometimes difficult and stressful, like to run away from my desk to the daycare, to get to the daycare before it closed, for example. That was not easy. And I would feel guilty. I'm leaving this pile of stuff here at my desk, running away. It just works out. That's my advice to everyone. It just works out. You know, it's important, and family and having a strong personal life, those things are important, and they make you happier people, which makes you a better physicist. That's what I think. And so, although I understand that most people will worry about how they're going to work it out, the fact is it does work out. It really just, you somehow you make the time, and no one is effective and efficient all during the day. You know, you're not losing anything by having a family. So I was worried about it, but I found out that it just works. And that's the advice I've always given students. And then people will say, what's the right time to have children? Well, my view was that if you're lucky enough, you can't really ask that question, because you don't really know what's going to happen in your life. If you're lucky enough to find someone that you want to have children with, fantastic. Already count yourself as lucky, but you're not going to be able to control the timing of all those things. It somehow can work out at any time, I think.
That's great. That's really nice to hear personally, but yeah, this is your podcast, not mine, or about you, not mine. Okay. Yeah. And I guess on that similar note of work-life balance, what do you personally do to relax and, maintain that work-life balance and enjoy your time outside of the office?
As I alluded to before, I try to put my family first, in the sense that I make time for family things. And I do work more hours than I would like to work. If my daughter's home from college, I'm going to make time to see her, so I just do what I can. When I have time to relax, I don't have a lot of great hobbies that are fun to talk about, like woodworking or anything like that, but I do love to watch movies. I like to read. And so those are my go-tos. If I'm going to relax on a Friday night or whatever, I'd be happy to watch a TV series that I like or whatever, that's what I enjoy doing. So not big on hobbies, but...
Yeah, that's fine.
Maybe when I retire, I can develop a really noteworthy hobby, but at the moment.
Yeah. What kind of books and movies do you like?
Oh, when I was a postdoc in Amsterdam, since I was living in a foreign country, I didn't necessarily know everyone. I would see just about every movie. So I don't have a huge standard. Now I don't have time to see as many movies. And so I like action movies. I like drama, science fiction, just about anything. Rom-coms are fine too. I'm not that picky. And for books, I don't know, just a really good novel, just, an excellent story is I love. And so, but I don't have, as I said, I don't have quite as much time as I'd like to participate in those things, but that's what I go to when I have time.
That's great. I think I will step back. Maybe I'll edit this back to the beginning. You already told us a little bit about your part in the long range plan and how you're involved, but maybe if you could explain, I guess, why is it so important, and should other young physicists and researchers care? Well, why should we care? I guess I don't know if that's the best wording.
Sure. Well, so the long range planning process is extraordinarily important in nuclear physics, and I know that other subfields of physics have their own processes, but every, let's say, 7 or 8 years, we produce a long-range plan. And the process is so important because all the different subfields, different collaborations, different groups of people who care about different things, they come together, they talk about what's important, and they produce input to the long-range planning process in the form of white papers. That is already such an important activity because basically people are coming together and talking about what's important, what matters for the field of nuclear physics. And why it's important is because there's only so much money. Right. Obviously, basic research in nuclear physics is funded by the DOE and by the NSF, and they don't have all the money that they need to do everything we would like to do. In our community in nuclear physics, we've been very successful at coming up with a focused group of recommendations, doing the hard work of considering all the input and prioritizing our recommendations for future funding. And because we've done that hard work and we don't, you know, attack each other, but instead have a vigorous debate about the different types of work we want to see, and then come up with a set of recommendations as a community, because we do that, then the funding agencies can respect that. And they try very hard to find the resources to do those things which are the highest priority for nuclear physics. So it needs to be a fairly long process, a very deliberate process. The part where we receive a lot of input from the different groups is very, very important. Because, for example, even within a group like QCD, which, you know, has hot and cold QCD, so we have the people who are doing JLab type physics, the people who are doing, you know, kind of heavy ion physics, and there's a million flavors of all these different things, right? They have to come together and talk about what's important to them and why and what the priority should be. Even within that group, that's hard. And then they produce a white paper with their recommendations, and then that goes into, and then that's combined with, you know, white papers from other people. So right now we're in the process where we have the different town halls meeting. We had the one on QCD at MIT 2 weekends ago, and then there'll be two others. So bottom line is, all this process is a very important part of getting input and feeding that up into the so-called writing committee. That's the long-range planning committee. It has, you know, basically 60 people on it. That's a big committee, but that's the group that is charged then with taking all that input and ultimately coming up with an agreed upon set of recommendations and priorities and initiatives that will put forth to the funding agencies. It'll help guide them as to where they should concentrate their resources. And so it is an extremely important process. And it is the process by which the field decides on, for example, what's the next major facility that needs to be constructed. You know, the EFRIB, you know, was mentioned in long-range plans going back 2 decades. First, it wasn't a recommendation. At first, it was that we need to study, you know, the possibility of radioactive ion beams, for example. And then the next time, it's slightly different. And eventually, it works its way up into the point where it's a high priority for new construction in the field. That vetting process is very important. And then, of course, it happened. You know, EFRIB was built, and EFRIB is a model, you know, in terms of being constructed on time and on budget. Now we have another big machine in the community that people are advocating for, the electron ion collider, and that's already in the process of moving through to be approved. That's a very expensive machine. And so you have to balance things like, you know, those expensive machines versus other experiments that are less expensive, but also important. And that's the very important process of considering all these things that the committee has to do. And so my role is to lead that committee, choose the people who are going to be on the committee, and to set a process. I hope I can do this, but, you know, to establish a process by which everyone feels good about their opportunity to present their opinion, the opportunity to consider all the input, and ultimately to come together to form a set of recommendations. Kind of nervous about it, but that's what I'm going to be doing for the next year.
I guess a follow-up is where do these recommendations go to between, you know, the committee making them and EFRIB or whatever being built? I mean, I don't know the entire system. Is this directly with the government that you're working or sending these recommendations to, or do you end up lobbying Congress or whatever, I guess, with Congress?
It's essentially all of the above. So we produce a document, which is about 100 pages, which has kind of an executive summary, which talks about the recommendations and, you know, the key points. And then the document lays out, why is electron ion collider physics important? Why is EFRIB physics important? Why do we need neutrinoless double beta decay experiment? These kinds of things are laid out. The physics of that is laid out, but in a language that's appropriate perhaps for a staffer in Congress to read, or, you know, you don't need to have be an expert to read and understand this document if it's well written. I mean, we have to make sure that we do that. So once this book is produced, you know, which has the executive summary and the recommendations, yes, it goes to the funding agencies. It also, we will socialize this with members of Congress, with staffers. We will try to make sure that we really present this and communicate this plan. But then it's up to the funding agencies, say the Department of Energy, the National Science Foundation, to, I mean, they have to work as part of the president's budget request to request money for very, you know, so that part I am a little fuzzy on, but, you know, there's a whole process by which they work with the president to request money from Congress, then Congress marks it up and, you know, eventually decides how much money to give. And so having a document like this will help not only the funding agencies, but Congress see, yeah, this is important and this deserves to be supported. And so it helps it as part of that process. Those are the main audiences. But I think this report is also very valuable, for example, for graduate students and people to look at who are in the field. You know, it's written at a level which, you know, should be very enjoyable to read for many people in nuclear physics. Hopefully that's our goal. We'll see if we can get there.
Yeah. So you're saying I should read this when I'm writing up NSF fellowship application and, you know, mm-hmm. use some of this terminology to understand how to convince people my research is important.
Yeah. Well, you know, of course, every time you write something, you're writing for a different audience, right? Yeah. And so, but I think it's a valuable thing to have read and to, you know, as background. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's great. Mm-hmm. And so does the Long Range Planning Committee, is it all about these big projects, the next accelerator or whatever, or are there also, you know, diversity, equity and inclusion, including more women in physics and stuff like that as a part of this?
Yeah, no, definitely diversity, equity, and inclusion is absolutely a part of it. It always has been a part of it, but obviously as times change, it becomes more and more important to really articulate and to put forward strategies for making sure that we're drawing on the whole population, you know, when we're talking about our field. And so all of the town halls are considering diversity, equity, and inclusion as part of their deliberations on the science. And so, for example, the QCD town hall that already took place, they put forward a recommendation about DEI as a, you know, to be considered by the committee. We were told very clearly by the Department of Energy, you know, upper management, that they did not want to see diversity, equity, and inclusion as an afterthought, an appendix, you know, an add-on to the report. It needed to be integrated throughout. And so we are taking that very seriously. How exactly it will manifest itself in the final report, I really don't know. You know, we're basically in the part where everyone can contribute ideas. But for sure, training an inclusive workforce is absolutely incredibly important for everyone. And we want to do whatever we can to make that more and more a reality.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, we're arguing that nuclear physics is important to the nation. And one of the reasons this is important to the nation is workforce. You know, workforce issues are not only about women in physics or other minorities. It's about training people with nuclear physics skills and expertise who can fulfill many roles at the national labs and in the government. So there are many different important aspects about nuclear physics have to do with workforce. And we're training people. We're producing science. We're training people. Those are two very, very important things. And in addition to diversity, equity, inclusion, we are also considering things like quantum information science or machine learning, artificial intelligence, ways that our community intersects with these other emerging fields, right? Because our community, both because we train a workforce and also because of the work for the physics we do, impacts those other fields. So the things going on in nuclear physics affect other fields of physics, for example, high energy physics, and they affect applications, nuclear power. I mean, there's so many ways in which the work of doing interesting and important and critical nuclear physics affects many other fields. And we also have to document that. That's an important part of our charge. And we have to put everything in the international context, you know, so what's going on in the rest of the world, you know, how do we maintain U.S. leadership in various areas? So we're going to have people on the committee who will be on subcommittees, you know, related to the international context or applications or impact on other subfields. And
that's really awesome. Sounds like definitely a challenge, but
yeah,
a rewarding one at the end, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe one question is, how can young researchers and if not students maybe get involved in some of this, make their voices heard on some of these long range plans and stuff?
No, that's a great question. In fact, you did ask that and I don't think I address that, but sort of one obvious way is to participate in these town halls. The American Physical Society Division of Nuclear Physics organized 3 town halls. One was on QCD, one on low energy nuclear astrophysics, and one on fundamental symmetries. But other groups of people are coming together and having other town halls as well, or group or collaboration meetings or anything, any other kind of meeting. First of all, young people can go to those meetings. Because I think it's incredibly interesting to hear what's presented. The level of the talks, the quality of the talks are usually very, very high. And I think it's a great opportunity for young people to go and just hear those talks and talk with other people in the field and hear what kinds of things are being proposed. People who attend those meetings can, in some cases, vote on the recommendations. I mean, they can really participate in the process. So being part, you know, really participating very actively in the process that leads to the input that comes to the committee is a very important thing. Another thing people can do is go to the DNP meeting, which is in New Orleans at the end of October. There'll be all kinds of, you know, discussions about the long range planning process at that meeting. There'll be different, you know, kinds of talks. There'll be discussions in the hallways. And I think that's another place for young people to get involved. And then I would recommend that people read the white papers. You know, if your field has produced a white paper or two that are relevant to you, I think it's important to read those and to know what people want to do X years from now. Because, you know, if you're 25 and you're in grad school, you know, you're going to be a lot older than that by the time the EIC is built, right? So, you know, so there's a long lead time is what I'm trying to get at. Carving out some time to be interested in future things is always sort of a good habit. Easier said than done, because you're always going to be busy, but to take the time to read the white papers and to know what's going on and go to conferences. That's my strongest advice.
That's great.
And the, you know, the list of people who are on the committee is posted on the NSAC webpage. So being at MSU, we'll know several people who are on that committee, and you can go ask them what their opinion is. You can talk to them about how to get involved, see what their opinion is about the process, you know, show interest in it. That's one way.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's great to hear. Good information to have out there. So I think my final question is just a general advice for students and young researchers, not necessarily to get involved in this, but just how to get to, I don't know, maybe how to get to where you are, you know, being this physicist or administrator or whatever, how to succeed.
Right. I think the most important advice is just to take it one step at a time. You know, when you're a grad student, the important thing is to work on things you're interested in, to really dig in and spend real time on it, and to try to spend time on things you really enjoy. In grad school, can be a little difficult, especially at the beginning and at the end, right? In the middle, it's kind of nice because you're doing your research and all things are good. But at the end, you have to get your thesis written and defend, and that can be a really stressful time. But for the most part, I would say to really just work on something that you're interested in as much as you can. And not always to worry so much about the future. You know, people can give you all kinds of advice like, oh, you have to do this or that in order to meet these people. So you can, you know, I just think it's important to focus on what you love doing and to do that really as well as you possibly can. And then I think that things work out after that. Yes, you'll apply for jobs, or you'll apply for postdocs, or you'll whatever, you know, whatever makes sense to you at the time. You don't always have to have everything mapped out and figured out, and certainly not to discourage yourself ahead of time by thinking it's not going to work out, right? Because it's time well spent. Getting a PhD is time well spent. If you're enjoying that research, there'll be a lot of different ways you can go, and you don't have to know what that way is going to be. And you don't have to know if you're a postdoc, whether you're going to go be a faculty member. You know, you can dig in and enjoy that work, and that will take care of itself. I think, you know, the future will take care of itself. Now, that's probably advice that not everyone would agree with, but I just think that it's important. The most important thing is to enjoy what you're doing, knowing that sometimes you're going to have to work really hard. Sometimes you're going to be stressed out, prepare for conference, whatever. Those can be very stressful times. But in the end, if you're just doing the best job you can and really digging into the details, I think that's the best advice. In the future, we'll work out at that point. Yeah. So that's sort of my philosophy.
Thanks so much for coming and talking to us and really explaining this long range plan is about and who you are. It's great to have
you. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Bill. And if there's something you think of that I didn't answer, please let me know.
Yeah.
And great.
Thank
terrific.
You.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. This podcast was created by Brian Stanley and Professor Huihuan Lin. Season 3 was interviewed by Bill Good and edited by Vara Lee Sikorkar. Thanks for listening.